Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Clark Elliott. He is a professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University. He's been doing that for 27 years. Also holds degrees in computer science. Just has an amazing amount of awareness of the brain from a different perspective here that we're talking about from the perspective of what is possible, how many different areas of our brain that we can use combined is so much stronger than we give ourselves credit for. So we're going to find out a little bit more about that and how he continued his story is he's going to continue about how he healed his brain injury and how anyone who has had any type of concussion or type of mild traumatic brain injury can also address these types of issues simply, children and adults alike. We will be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Clark Elliott. Now, Clark, as an artificial intelligence professor, you have a very, enormous amount of information and knowledge about the human brain, but you've always been interested in this topic even before you had your brain injury. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And there is a certain irony that a professor of artificial intelligence would become his own laboratory for
Right.
the medium
Well,
of concussion.
he told me the story of a in your laboratory, actually, you have a computer that simulates basically your brain, right? Is it built off of your brain?
My area was computing emotions, and I followed on the work of a man named Andrew Oritoni, who is one of the world's most well-respected cognitive scientists. And my job was to build a computer program that simulated many aspects of human emotion, both from the perspective of the computer, where we would create what we call intelligent agents that themselves would carry an emotional state and relate not only to other computer agents, but also to humans. But additionally, we're able to make some sense of the emotional life of humans with whom they were interacting.
And so, can your computer actually come up with its own emotions?
After a fashion, yes. As we have said, the human brain is staggeringly complex, and that would also be true of the human emotion system. And these were not real emotions. They were computer simulations of human emotion. But these agents did become quite complex over time. I would come into my office and I would keep this agent running over the course of several weeks, and I would notice it was now angry at me. And I could speak to it that I had a text-to-speech interface even back in the 90s before these were common. And it had, faces. These agents would have faces with, 70 or 80 emotion expressions. And I would ask it, well, why are you angry? And it would say something after the fashion of, well, it's Tuesday morning and you always interact with me on Tuesday morning, but this Tuesday morning you didn't. So on the one hand, I'm sad because this is one of my goals is to interact with you on a regular basis. And on the other hand, I have this principle that says this is something that you should do. And taken together, my distress and the fact that you violated the principle causing this distress now makes me angry at you. So
Wow. So this is interesting so many different ways because it goes off of patterns, right? So over a repetitive pattern of you feeding back to the computer and the program, assimilating it, and then bouncing off of you, it created this pattern and you interrupted the pattern, so therefore it registered it as sad, right? Somewhere
yes.
like, okay.
And these agents had personalities, which are necessary if you're going to have emotions. So, on the one hand, it had what we call an appraisal component. It would look at something that happens in the world and make appraisals whether that was something that it liked or something it didn't. Or it might make a judgment that's a good thing that someone has done or a bad thing. And then, additionally, they would have a way of expressing any emotions that might arise. And I would call that the temperament part of their personalities.
So,
So they would have something, maybe
wow.
24 different categories of emotion that they were capable of. And then within each category, there were many gradations of intensity, along with something like 20 different variables that would contribute to those intensities. So they would get quite complex.
Now, doesn't this show that we create through patterns as well? Our brains are, of course, very much like the computer, vice versa, actually, but that we, through repetitive patterns of correspondence with people and how we relate to them and how they relate back to us and our expectancy of how they should relate back to us and our disappointment if that pattern doesn't get repeated and connected. Same thing for us, of course, that
Very
we.
insightful, Lisa. You are absolutely correct.
And.
And this, of course, was an attempt not only to build computers that have emotion, but as you say, to understand how humans work as well.
What do you hope to do with these computers in the future?
One area of research that this took me into was the understanding of stories, what makes something a story, because humans operate so much in the stories we tell, the stories we remember, and as an organizational tool for our lives, we tell the story of our very own lives. And most of the work prior to this emotion work, most of the work on stories attempted to make sense of plots, that what someone did and what someone else did as a response to the original action. But I think back to this, there was that old skit that we used to see on Sesame Street called Love of Chair. It was this great soap opera about this boy, sort of an unattractive boy, sitting in a chair, and it would have soap opera music in the background and would ask questions like, will the boy sit in the chair tomorrow? And does the boy love sitting in the chair? And it occurs to me that this is the essence of what makes a story, is the emotion fabric that is in it. So if we say, Lisa, the boy sat in the chair, it's not that interesting. It's not really a story. And if we say, the boy sat in the chair, there was a pink wall, there was a palm tree next to it, there was a large car sitting in the palm tree. We can get very complex, but it's still not very interesting, and it's not really a story. But if as soon as we make a character that cares about something that happened, that appraises one of these events as relevant to their emotion system, now it becomes a story. So if we say, the boy sat in the chair, but he knew he shouldn't be. The boy sat in the chair, but he was feeling guilty about it. The boy sat in the chair. He was jealous of Lisa, who was in the other chair. Now, all of a sudden, we have the kernel of what makes this a story. So I realized using this emotion research that I had developed for building these computer agents, we also have the essence of computational understanding of what makes the stories work.
Interesting. So we this is chicken or the egg. It's you, we really have an understanding of how humans are operating. So we can take our stories and change the story just as you can change the special processing or a processor in a computer. And
Yes.
it can actually calibrate in a different way. So in this understanding, with this understanding, how have you changed your life or your relationship with your brain injury, and changed your story or your children? How do you parent differently based on this information?
Well, here's one example I can give. In building this model of human emotion, it became necessary to analyze hundreds and hundreds, many hundreds of stories of how humans interact with other human beings as part of the emotional fabric of society. And the way the theory was developed, the theory that I computed, was to look for what was necessary to compute, to be able to represent all of these stories that embodied human emotion, and what could we get rid of? What was sufficient? And those parts that we didn't need, we could get rid of. And one of the things I found in this analysis was that the emotion of anger, which is quite dominant in the human race, unfortunately, has two components. One is that there is always something that we want. There's a goal that we want. There's something we want to preserve or something we'd like to get. And that's just because we want it. And there's also a component of an appraisal of right and wrong, that there's somebody, some person who's done something praiseworthy or something blameworthy. And in the case of anger, someone's performed a blameworthy action that now violates our goal. It interferes with our keeping something or it interferes with our getting something. And so we get angry at them. Well, if you're looking at how to modulate anger in life, if you break this down into saying, oh, well, there's something I want, And then there's a principle that I have, and someone violated that principle, and that's causing me to get angry. Well, you always can choose which principles you adopt. It's harder to change those things that you want, but you certainly can change what you believe to be right and wrong. And thus, it turns out that if you defeat these principles, if you hold a principle a little bit less dear, you may find that you get less angry.
Now, isn't that also the case with a traumatic brain injury, is that that doesn't happen, that there's the anger spikes from 0 to 10 without a reason of necessarily something that we want and somebody violating a principle of something that we want? It's pretty much unreasonable, isn't it?
In my case, I didn't have the emotional difficulties that many people with these brain injuries do have. What was your experience? Did you also find a change in your emotional life, Lisa, with your injury?
I don't really quite recall at the time. I do think that it was more of a dead response. I think it was actually the opposite for me at the time. Yeah,
that also was true for me, this flattening of affect, we call that. And in the book, I discuss why that happened to me. Interestingly, as an AI professor, this being a laboratory in my own brain, so to speak, the way this would work was my body and my cognition would slow down. In fact, at some times, it might take me 5 minutes just to reach for a salt shaker. But that's because my body was operating so slowly, and I could see the wheels turning slowly as I thought through setting up goals of how to move my hand or how to process something during the day. But what we call the metacognitive voice, that is the part that makes us human, where we can observe ourselves within the scene of our life, that was operating in real time. And what I found of those times when my affect was flattening out in the way that I believe you're describing, is that I lost the symbols of relationship. I couldn't understand where my body ended and that I'm here and someone else is out there. And I think this was also central in why I lost my relationship to God during this period. That without being able to represent I'm here and someone else differently is over there, losing the basics of that relationship processing, we can't have emotions in the same way, and thus we end up with a flattening of affect.
Imagine all that was corrected by these brain glasses. That is just a phenomenal thing. It's just amazing. we're going to go to callers here. There's a lot of people have questions for you, ranging from brain trauma questions to questions about AI. You okay with taking callers?
I am, and I'll be curious among these callers. Once the book came out, the most dominant theme I'm hearing, Lisa, is not the hope so many of these with brain injuries can get better, but rather just the overwhelming sense of relief that someone finally understands what has happened to them. I hear over and over again, I have Clark Elliott, I have tears running down my face that finally someone believes me. And I wonder if that theme will show up also tonight.
Let's find out. Let's start off with Larry in our wild card line. In Hollywood, California. Larry, do you have a question or a comment for Clark Elliott?
Yeah, I live in Hollywood, California, and I've heard a story for years about Howard Hughes, how he crashed one of his prototype airplanes in the Hollywood Hills and suffered frontal lobe brain damage, and they didn't detect it until after his death through autopsies and things. So I was wondering if you'd ever heard of that. And I researched it, and it is a true story. And I was curious if that might have been responsible for his odd behavior later on in his life, being a recluse in Las Vegas.
Interesting question. Clark, do you have any perspective on that?
You know, I have not heard that.
Yeah.
But now that you mention it, it makes such perfect sense. So many that experience these brain injuries, the frustrating part is no one else understands it, and we often ourselves don't understand what has happened. So
yes,
we used to hear about these blast victims. You know, we have so many blast victims returning in the military now, and such a lack of understanding of what's happened to them. And back in World War I and World War II, they would be labeled as, oh, well, that's shell shock. And, you know, they're cowards because they emotionally can't handle it. And we're thinking, no, this is a brain injury. And when you mention what happened to Howard Hughes and the extreme changes in cognition, it makes perfect sense that this could have been what happened to him.
It absolutely does. Thank you for your call. Appreciate that, Larry. Let's go to East of the Rockies, John in Lima, Ohio. John, do you have a comment or a question for Clark Elliott?
Yes, I have a comment and a question.
Great.
I was wondering if he had ever heard of Susanna Cahalan. She wrote the book Brain on Fire.
Doesn't ring a bell to me, but does it you, Clark?
I know the title, Brain on Fire. Unfortunately, I don't recall why, with apologies to Vena Cahalan.
What is your question about that?
Well, you know, the thing about her instance is that she didn't have a instance to point to as far as an accident or a traumatic incident. Hers come on rather naturally, and she'd have died long before they would have ever been able to have done any kind of treatment with glasses or ophthalmology or anything of that nature. But she managed to come back through both plasmapheresis and immunotherapy.
Ah, so different therapies to get to a different result. Yeah, Clark, well, you mentioned there were a lot of therapies, right?
Yes, and isn't this the woman that was almost spontaneously overnight, she just woke up with a, I guess what we could call a brain condition. That's a, I seem to recall that. Yes, I think if there's a theme, I got lucky. And Donnelly Marcus, Deborah Zielinski, the optometrist that practices these neurodevelopmental optometric techniques, they are brilliant clinicians. And at the ClarkElliott.com website, I refer to the NORA, Neurooptometric Rehabilitation Association, that has maybe 600 or 700 members in North America that are also dedicated to these same techniques. But if we look at the Brain Injury Association of America website and other websites like this, there are many, many different approaches to treating brain injury. And the point is that we need to engage in this dialogue because there are effective treatments, and the traditional treatment for brain injury is that there is no treatment. So we know we can do better than that.
Yes.
We also are now getting better brain scans, these SPECT SPECT scans, these qualitative EEGs, giving 3D imaging. This kind of brain imaging also is giving us some insight, empirical insight into what's going on in the brain. At that ClarkElliott.com website, I do in fact give pictures for EEG, QEEG, and Loretta scans showing the immediate effect of wearing these therapeutic brain glasses on something like 19 different channels of brain waves that are being measured. So, yes, we can't know, but we can probably guess that in the next 10 years, there are going to be phenomenal breakthroughs and changes.
Yes, of course, with all the brain research that's coming out lately. Thank you very much for your call. And we are actually going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to answer more of your calls. Any questions that you have, either about the brain conditions or the artificial intelligence work that Professor Elliott does as well. So thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break and we will be back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Clark Elliott. And the name of his book is The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. We have so many callers here. I want to get to some of the phones here. Let's go to our wild card line four, John from Forsyth, Missouri. Hi, John. Do you have a question for Clark Elliott?
Hi, Lisa. Yes.
Hi.
Dr. Elliott, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
You're an answer to prayer. I'm telling you right now.
Oh, wow. Why do you say that?
Well, my wife and I are both 58 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife has had 5 strokes, and I've had one.
Wow.
And
oh my.
Yeah, it's like I'm hearing a big comparison to what's going on in our lives as to the, you know, the brain traumas.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I've known ever since I had my stroke that there's there's more out there. In other words, I know that there's more that can be done.
Yes.
The doctors that we've seen say, well, you'll have to live with this the rest of your life.
Oh, no, yes, you don't have to. And yes, there are so many more solutions. And I'm so grateful that this show opened the door for you on that.
Oh, it has.
John.
Good.
John, my heart does go out to both you and your wife to live with this. I will comment that while stroke is different from the damage that I suffered and is the typical damage from brain trauma from an accident, at some elemental level, brain damage is brain damage. And I believe that many of the techniques that worked with me, which were primarily visual spatial treatments using retinal inputs to the brain, many of those treatments probably can also help to make stroke victims more comfortable.
That's amazing.
And you are hearing the same thing that I heard for 8 years. Clark Elliott, you will never recover. This kind of brain damage is permanent. And yet we are finding that not only can someone like me fully recover, I am fully recovered in all ways from my brain damage, that concussion can be treated. There is a likelihood that we can do a much better job with stroke than we currently are doing. So I hope that this will obtain in your life. And what I do hear echoed, as I mentioned before, the most common theme I hear when people write to me or speak to me after a book signing is just relief that finally someone understands. A woman wrote and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm telling my friends, read this book and you'll know who I am. I'm telling my family, read this book. This is my life.
Yes.
This is what happened to me. I'm storming back to my neurologist's office this afternoon to tell him, you see, I was not lying. Mm. I'm not crazy now, and I never was. This is what happened to me.
Thank you. Yes, and that you're going to do the same thing. And John, you can also go to clarkelliott.com for some of those research, some of the research material that's on his website, and take that information to your doctor as well.
And if nothing else, these neurodevelopmental optometric tests, these are a standard battery of 2 to 3 hours of tests that give critical, vital information about the visual processing that's going on in our brains. And these are non-invasive. There's no surgery. We're not taking drugs. In the best case, we can find that there are treatable conditions. And in the worst case, well, we spent money on an office visit. Why not?
All right. We need to actually take another quick break. Thank you so much for your call, John. I really appreciate it. And we will be right back to answer more of your calls when we come back after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Clark Elliott. And we are going to return to your questions here. Let's go to our wild card line 5, Sarah, in New Hampshire. Sarah, do you have a question for Clark Elliott?
Yes. Hello, Mr. Elliott. I had a similar accident as you. I was waiting to turn left, and somebody rear-ended me, and I got this head injury. This was September last year. I'm having a severe problem with my eyes. They're very extremely light sensitive. I have problems with blurry vision, all kinds of problems with them. I've seen a bunch of specialists here in New Hampshire. Earlier this month, I went to Mass Eye and Ear Neuro-Ophthalmology Department, and even the guy there said there's nothing he could do for me, just I need to wait it out.
Wow.
And I'm wondering, is there a specialist in my area like Deborah that maybe could help me? Because this is just one of the problems I'm having. I'm having a lot of the similar problems that you discussed. But this is my major problem that's really affecting me in my life. And if I could find somebody like Deborah that helped you, that could help me, it would just be such a godsend.
Yes. I mean, how would she find someone in her area? Or is it even worth it to go travel to where this person is that helped you?
Sarah, first, I am so sorry to hear that you're having those difficulties, because trust me, I understand them from the inside out. With these rear-end collisions, of course, this is one of the most common difficulties with brain injury, is that the visual cortex is at the back of the brain, and that is often damaged with concussion. And as mentioned at the beginning of the show, we are primarily visual spatial processors, so this vision processing is almost always affected with head injury. And you are not alone in saying that you've gone for help and are told, well, there's nothing we can do. That's what I was told 15 years ago, and unfortunately, I'm hearing this over and over and over again, that that is often the treatment options that are given to people even now. However, Sarah, there are possibilities. First, at the ClarkElliott.com website, over on the right-hand side, I list the websites for both Donald E. Marcus, called designsforstrongminds.com, and for Deborah Zielinski, which is the mindeyeconnection.net or .com. So you can get to their practices. Of course, these are two brilliant, pioneering researcher clinicians in their own right, and I can highly endorse their work because they are so effective not only with me but many others. But also there's a reference to the Neuro-Optometric Rehabilitation Association, and there may be people there that can help you as well. Now, you know, each practice is different, and each head injury, of course, is different. So I would want someone to be a good consumer. But if nothing else, you could contact Dr. Zielinski or Dr. Marcus and ask for references in your area. It is unfortunate that the numbers are against us. With these 5,000 concussions that we know about every day, there's still maybe only a handful of practitioners in each state that actually know well how to use these techniques.
And I ask one more thing. I also have other problems that I didn't hear you discuss tonight. One is, it seems like I have a hard time leaving the house. I always feel like I'm missing something, like I'm forgetting or missing something. Even though I may have everything I need, it's like I struggle leaving because I, in my head's telling me like I'm forgetting something. And then I also have this experience, kind of like
you'll laugh.
Why are you laughing?
Sarah, because I captured that, of course, exactly in the book. I know exactly what it is you're talking about. It's a pattern matching difficulty.
Okay, how about the deja vu? Like, if I am trying to, say, read a book, which I struggle with right now, I feel like I've already read it. Or I'll be watching a TV show, and it's like I know what's happening as it happens, but I've never seen it before. It's very strange, and I've never, it's like deja vu, but it's not really deja vu.
What is that? What is that in the brain? And by the way, just continue to look up his website because there are a lot of resources there.
Yeah, as soon as I get home, I'm going to do that.
Good girl.
I want to get your book today.
Thank you so much for the call. Clark, what is that where it does feel like a deja vu or it repeats itself? Is it the brain freezing or what is that?
I don't know this exact experience that Sarah has had, but I definitely found myself questioning what the nature of being a human being is, that we do actually begin to operate closer to reality in some ways because our filters, our sensory filters, are disturbed and in many ways removed. So as a concussive, Sarah is now seeing parts of the world that we ordinarily just filter out. As we look around a room, we're seeing, one ten thousandth of what's actually there, and the rest of it is just automatically discounted. But when Sarah's sensory filters are not working correctly, there's an awful lot of information that she's getting that we don't ordinarily have to process. Unfortunately, it means that we have to manually sift through all of that, and it leads to a lot of confusion. But at other times, it leads to a certain kind of creativity and a different way of seeing the world. We have to wonder if maybe that's what's happening in Sarah's case.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, the brain is such a delicate, complex organism, and the fact that you're even able to capture any of it, just a tenth of it, on your through AI is really fascinating to me. But you've heard this, you know, phrase a zillion times, we only use 10% of our brain. I believe that we use so much more. You've really explained it here. What do you feel about that?
I'm thinking of the movie Lucy that's out popular now, claiming that we're only using a small portion of our
brain. Right.
I think maybe a more responsible answer is what we do just to get through the day requires phenomenal amounts of processing. Is that being a human being is an extremely, fabulously, stunningly complex task. And we need that brain horsepower just to do what we do and getting through a normal day.
Yes.
Our mental properties are ways to predict the future, to reason about the world. These require staggering amounts of processing, and that's why we need these brains that are so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
And
yes, we do.
I want to comment, just go back to something that Larry had said, you know, who called, I believe, from Hollywood. He was talking about Howard Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that one of the most insidious aspects of concussion is all of the brain damage that is probably flying under the radar that we don't know about. Mm. It's being masked as emotional difficulties or trouble at work, or appears insidiously as learning disabilities or attention disorder in our children. An interesting study out of New Zealand was a rugby study that I referred to at my website, where they took baseline testing for these rugby athletes before the season, then tested all of the athletes during the season. What they found was that for every one concussion they knew about, five more were flying under the radar. And this has to be reflected in the general population as well. Mm. That there was a slip on the ice a year before,
yes,
or a snowboarding accident, and we don't realize that that's why we're having these troubles now. And instead we're getting treated for attention disorder when in fact it was a brain injury that's causing this.
Wow, that's very illuminating. Let's go to a few more callers if we have time here. Let's go to Susan in New Mexico, our first-time caller. Susan, do you have a question for Clark Elliott?
Good morning. Clark, I just want to tell you, I haven't read your book, but I've been jumping up and down for the last hour. Feeling validated for my spouse. So he recently passed away in April with prostate cancer after a very valiant fight. But previous to that, he had what later became understanding that he had head injuries and concussions probably from the time he was a little kid. One of the things I do want to say is that through our research and some other stuff, we've come to realize that people don't, when he had his last one about 10, 15 years ago, we went through a very harsh experience with the place that he was working with in terms of workers' compensation and how disdainful the neuropsych was, having no seemingly interest in looking at the fact that he had probably cumulative damage over the years. The whole concept of concussion syndrome at that time, they were looking at it very negatively. And I think after that, very soon after that, you got to see what was happening with young men, young women in sports, and they were beginning to realize that they, had to pull people out of games and whatnot and give their brains time to rest.
There's a lot more awareness about that now, definitely. Yes.
I just want to share something with you. So when my spouse had his last brain injury, we got the same spiel, which everybody has, which is, we can't do anything for you. So this man took it upon himself to develop his own strategy. On the lower spectrum of technology, he began to do puzzles at ridiculous rates. He was doing puzzles at home. I thought it was really crazy.
Really?
Not only did he do puzzles, but he went to some woman here in town, and I don't know what her name is, but for light therapy. He went for light therapy for months. And let me tell you something, because of his own self-advocacy and because of tenacity that he had, what I began to see in terms of seeing the synapses beginning to come back together, what I began to see was his affect, which, of course, they were looking at as malingering, but it was dull because he had a brain injury.
That is fascinating. Gosh, we have a whole body of research about that on our website right now at theawareshow.com/light. And that's one of the main bodies of work that I've gone into. It's so fascinating that you just mentioned that, Susan. Fascinating. Yes. Light therapy has incredible benefits for brain neuroplasticity, depression, everything. So thank you for bringing that up. Appreciate
Susan,
that.
What was your husband? What is your husband's name? What was his name?
His name is Robert.
Robert. So we have to say, Robert, good job, that he was an advocate, that he sought the kind of treatment that could help. He stood up to people suggesting he was a malingerer, even though we know that this was a brain injury. And that this
I really want to bring up the thing about for young men, how often it is that they get cumulative. They don't just have one brain injury. They seem to have more and more and more. And I think that's important for people to realize that it's a cumulative thing as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And I'm so looking forward to reading your book. And you've just put a fire under a butt that's been feeling very lost for the last 4 months.
Good for you. Thank you so much
for
calling.
Sorry for your loss here. She raises an important issue. I think Susan does say something here at the end, very important. And that is, especially given our student athletes in high school and college level, is that, as I mentioned from this rugby study, the King study out of New Zealand, that it is very likely that for every concussion we know about, there are five more that are flying under the radar that we don't know about. Another piece that we have to attend to is these concussion injuries are permanent. Most of the 5,000 concussions we know about, and who knows how many we don't know about, most of these people feel better after a while, and that's because their brains naturally take advantage of plasticity and work around the damage.
Some do.
They know that damage is permanent, and that's why they can suffer so much if they're out there and suffer another injury. Now, taken together, this means we are putting these athletes back out on the field, in many cases, not even realizing they've had an injury at a time when they are most susceptible
to
damage.
Oh.
And unfortunately, we have the science. These are simple pen and paper tests, a simple 3-minute reading test in the case of King Divic, and we could be giving this information to parents and our student athletes and letting them make actually informed decisions.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I am glad that she mentioned that light therapy part of it too, because there's I forgot completely about that. That's something that can also help with the brain injuries as well. So thank you so much, Clark. You have done such a great job today about bringing awareness around the solutions of multiple concussions, brain injuries, bumps on the head, and one begets the next quite often because they're not paid attention to soon enough, and that there are possibilities and solutions, and you are a very credible guest to bring that information to the forefront. I really appreciate your time tonight and what you do for so many people. Thank you.
Lisa, thank you so much. And of course, we do share this experience of brain injury. Thank you so much for this having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, the name of his book is called The Ghost in My Brain, and you can look at his website, which is clarkelliott.com, and it's two L's and two T's. All right. And that is it for me today as well. You can also look on my website, which is theawareshow.com. That's theawareshow.com to find out where the shows are that I'm going to be broadcasting on all week and always do. And it's just a pleasure being with you on Coast to Coast AM. Deep, deep pleasure. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.